From Jeffersonville to Altoona, Port Allegheny to Waynesburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, from a knockdown fight among gubernatorial candidates to a re-gerrymander of the state's congressional districts, the 2018 primary campaign has been chaotic. Chris Nicholas of Eagle Consulting is here to preview what voters will find when they go to the polls on Tuesday. For insights on the Me Too movement and the impact of the Bill Cosby trial, Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation has Kristen Hauser from the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape in the Community Benefit Spotlight. And partisan politics are also at play as President Trump tries to fill vacancies on the federal bench. Beth Ann Mumford of Americans for Prosperity PA has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Voters across Penn's Woods will go to the polls on Tuesday and select their party's nominees for governor, lieutenant governor, U.S. senator, along with seats in the U.S. Congress and the state legislature. Chris Nicholas is a veteran political consultant with Eagle Consulting. He keeps an eye on everything political in Pennsylvania and joins us now to talk about the upcoming primary. Chris, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Chris, we have the primary election coming up in just a couple of days. It seems the race that's getting most of the attention is the race for the Republican nomination for governor of Pennsylvania. Seems more like a WWE match than a race for governor. What in the world is going on there?
Governor Tom Wolf does not face a challenge in his Democratic primary on Tuesday. So Republicans are battling it out for the right to challenge him in the fall. You have incumbent state senator Scott Wagner, who hails from the central part of the state, York County. You have businessman and former member of the 82nd Airborne, Paul Mango, who hails from Pittsburgh, and Laura Ellsworth, an attorney who also hails from Pittsburgh. So the two men in that battle, Mango and Wagner, have been going at each other tooth and nail for about a month now on TV. I found that a little bit shocking, not because, oh, it's terrible that candidates go after each other, that's fine. But it was so early in the primary, and these guys were still relatively unknown, and in political consulting parlance, they still had room to grow just by allowing people to realize they existed. So they've been going at it pretty hard. Laura Ellsworth hasn't raised as much money, so she has not yet had a presence on TV. About 2 weeks out, she's apparently going to start some, so maybe it will help her. But right now, it seems to be a two-man battle. And the polling I've seen, Loman, is kind of all over the map. I've seen polling that has Senator Wagner way out ahead. I've seen polling that had them neck and neck. I've seen polling that had Mr. Mango slightly ahead. So the race has been, you know, it's just new candidates, so people don't know them. Senator Wagner has going for him as the state party, the Republican Party of Pennsylvania, has endorsed him. So that gives him a lot more ground troops.
What sort of advantage is that? The state Republican Party doesn't appear to have as much money to spend as it has in past years. But in terms of organization, in a close race, that can make a big difference?
Well, Pennsylvania is a big place, Loman, 45,500 square miles. So with the endorsement, you have a ready-made supply of Republican Party members who can help you put out your signs, work for you on election day, make phone calls. The other candidates, Mango and Ellsworth, they have to work hard to generate that, where Senator Wagner has it right there. Regardless of how much money the Republican Party has or the Democratic Party has, it's still a bonus to be endorsed by the party.
In terms of Laura Ellsworth, you mentioned that she doesn't have much money, has not had the television presence of the other two. Is the fact that the other two are bludgeoning each other on a daily basis possibly creating an opening for her to sort of run up the middle?
It could. It's an opportunity. How effective she's been at taking advantage of that, we'll see come Tuesday. So voters don't vote for candidates they don't know, really, unless the other two are really toxic. The interesting thing for me, and this will be of special interest to your listeners in and around Philadelphia, is that there are no candidates for governor or senator on the Republican side that hail from Philadelphia or the suburban counties. Like I said, Mango and Ellsworth are from Pittsburgh, and Senator Wagner's from York County. So a lot of the votes in a primary come out of that area. It's a vote-rich area. Mm-hmm. It's the largest media market in the state. So who will those people vote for? Because there's no hometown or region person there.
Also tends to be a region where party endorsements matter more in the Southeast. What impact does the fact that you have Paul Mango and Laura Ellsworth sharing a geographic base have, particularly on Paul Mango? Can she siphon enough votes away from him to make a difference?
I'm sure the Ellsworth people don't think about their campaign as siphoning off votes from other people. They think about it as doing theirs. That's why I said a moment ago, Philadelphia is so important. If you take all three Western TV markets in the state, Erie, Johnstown, Altoona, and Pittsburgh, and put it all together, they have almost as many votes as the Philadelphia TV market. So you have to figure that Senator Wagner will do better in central Pennsylvania. The other two will battle it out in Pittsburgh. And like I said, the big deal is what happens in the Philadelphia market, as people may realize when they go into the polls. If they know nothing else about the candidate, they know the candidate's name. From that, they're probably 95% able to figure out the gender. And then below that is the county of residence for that candidate. So if you're a voter in, say, Lancaster County, and you don't really know a lot about the candidates, and you see Scott Wagner underneath his name, York County, history has shown you're more likely to pull the lever for someone who's more local to you. That's just kind of what that's why you and I talk about this every year.
We are talking with veteran political consultant Chris Nicholas of Eagle Consulting about the upcoming Pennsylvania primary election, now just days away. Chris, you mentioned the fact that there are no gubernatorial or U.S. Senate candidates from the southeastern part of the state, but lieutenant governor, there are a number of candidates there. Lieutenant governor often tends to be an afterthought, but this year, both Scott Wagner and Paul Mango have selected a running mate. Is that different, and will it have any impact?
They have selected a running mate. It doesn't make any difference in real time, except that they campaign together. In Pennsylvania, candidates for governor and lieutenant governor run in separate primaries, and the winners become the ticket. So you could have an instance where Mr. Mango wins his primary, but his selected running mate doesn't win hers, so you kind of have a mishmash together. So it is interesting that we've seen not one but two candidates do this. Will it help? We'll see. There are, I think, about 10 candidates together on both parties running for lieutenant governor. Often that is a gamble to see what ballot position you get, what happens to the other candidates, can you get there on a wing and a prayer. On the Republican side, we have several women running. Peg Luxick, who has kind of a blast from the past. She ran for governor a couple times in the 90s. Kathy Coder from Allegheny County. Diana Irie Vaughn, a longtime county commissioner from Washington County. And then Jeff Bartos, the candidate from Montgomery County. On the Democratic side, you have added intrigue because Governor Wolf is publicly not backing his current lieutenant governor, Mike Stack from Philadelphia. I wrote some stories 4 years ago when those two got put together in the Democratic primary of 2014 and said they never campaigned together in the primary because they weren't a ticket then. They weren't together on election night in the primary. They weren't together election night in the general. And I'm not sure they were ever in the same place at the same time. And since then, their public relationship has been drowned out by some of the scandals by Mr. Stack. So the question on the Democratic side is, who will Wolf be paired with? He is not publicly putting his finger on the scale for anybody except to say that he's not for Stack.
Well, that's going to be very interesting to see how that plays out. And of course, we also have statewide primary going on the Republican side for a seat in the United States Senate. On the Democratic side, incumbent U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. running yet again for the U.S. Senate. Republicans have a primary, but it's been very quiet compared to the gubernatorial primary.
I agree. You have two Republicans vying for the chance to take on Bob Casey as Senator Casey tries for his third term in the U.S. Senate. You have incumbent Congressman Lou Barletta from what used to be the 11th district. I'm not sure what district he's in now, but it used to be the 11th district, basically from Luzerne County down into the Harrisburg area. And he's being challenged by State Rep Jim Christiana from the far western part of the state in Beaver County. You have some stylistic differences there. Christiana is more of a movement conservative. Barlett is known for his jihad against illegal immigration and being extremely close to President Trump. If you may remember, he and Congressman Tom Marino from a neighboring district were big original backers of the president. I would assume that Congressman Barletta is saving his money to go after Casey in the fall. Jim Christiana, who has not endorsed Congressman Barletta, has struggled to get his name out. So it has been kind of a sleeper compared to the governor's race.
And also, even more importantly, what will they do in the general election? We saw last year the southeastern part of the state, particularly the collar counties, the four counties outside of Philadelphia, we saw a Democrat blue wave sweep over those counties in countywide races last year. We're going to talk in a minute about congressional seats. It looks like there could be a blue wave there. Is it going to be very difficult, particularly for Lou Barletta, to compete in that region of the state, given the fact it's so anti-Trump and he is so tied to Donald Trump?
I think that is cause for concern, and also his very stringent record on immigration does not mesh with even most Republicans. They're little on Democrats and independents. So the question is, if he does, quote unquote, bleed votes in Southeast PA, can he pick them up in other parts of the state to kind of make up for that? So again, the Democrats will focus heavily on the southeastern part of the state with Philadelphia. That's where so many of their voters are.
Now let's talk about what has been one of the oddest set of developments in at least recent, if not ever, political history, and that are races for seats in the United States Congress. We had the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania decide to re-gerrymander the districts in the middle of the race. As you look around the state, Chris, are we looking at a blue wave in Pennsylvania, or can Republicans remain competitive?
Well, the five Democrats on the Supreme Court decided that they had the power to not just rule a current map unconstitutional, but they had the power to write their own map. That, to me, was extraordinary. For 5 weeks in Pennsylvania, no one knew what congressional district they lived in. Looking across the state, the new map the Democrats wrote, every safe Republican seat got packed with more Republicans, and every competitive Republican seat had more Democrats added to it. So they definitely put their thumb on the scale in an attempt, in their words, to, you know, remediate what they thought had been done wrong in 2011. So there are a couple seats now that are empty. There's no incumbent in them. The 9th district in NEPA has no incumbent. The 4th district in Montgomery County has no incumbent. The 14th district out of western Pennsylvania, even if Congressman Murphy had not resigned, he would not be in that district. So you have these big, open, empty districts with no congressmen. So it looks like that there will be somewhat of a Democratic wave in the fall. Just looking at the way the districts are drawn, you can look at a couple that are kind of gone, and now we've had this added turmoil with Congressman Pat Meehan from the old 7th District resigning 2 weeks ago, and Congressman Charlie Dent about to resign any day now in May. So you're going to have situations where there'll be a special election in an old district that is dead, plus the regular election. And if the special election's on general election day in November, you'll have people who would be a congressman for 2 or 3 months in a district that doesn't exist.
So as we look at this, and another factor here, and you touched on it with Congressman Meehan, Congressman Dent, both resigning early. So obviously they're not running. We have, what, 3 other incumbent Republicans who are not running for reelection. Why all the retirements and all the decisions to resign early? What's scaring all these congressmen out of the race?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. You've got a difficult political environment. You have a president that can't get on track and get above 40% approval. You have all these maps going crazy. Some people have just kind of come to the end of their line and have another job lined up perhaps and have moved on. But we are seeing an unprecedented level of turnover in the congressional delegation this year on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, all of their now 6 incumbents are are running for re-election. So it had been 11-5 Republican Democrat. It's now 12-6 after the special election. I could definitely see a situation where it's 10-8 Republican or even 9-9.
We also have half of the Pennsylvania State Senate and all of the Pennsylvania House of Representatives up for election this year. Is it possible that this could become a waiver that would imperil the Republican majorities in those chambers, or are those races so localized that Republicans are pretty safe?
We do have a record number of retirements on the Republican side in the legislature, especially the House. And then across the state, you have situations where a congressional seat is open. So a state senator and a state rep have run for that, and now there are primaries for their old seats. I think you could write a scenario where you see their majorities trimmed, but I think even the Democrats in their wildest dreams don't think they can take back the Pennsylvania House or Senate.
Well, the stage will be set for all of this on Tuesday, May 15th. Polls open at 7 a.m. They're open till 8 p.m.
Please vote.
Please vote. Your opportunity to have a say in all of what's turned out to be a wild and woolly year. Chris Nicholas, veteran political consultant, Eagle Consulting. Chris, how can folks get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter at Eagle63. My website is eagleconsult.com. Thanks, Loman.
Chris Nicholas, thank you for being here. The Bill Cosby trial put the Me Too movement on full display here in Pennsylvania and nationwide. Joe Geiger from the First Nonprofit Foundation talks about the impact with Kristen Hauser from the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. Joe?
Thank you, Loman. Thank you, Kristen, for being a guest on the Lincoln Radio program.
Thanks for having me.
Kristen, would you share with the listeners a little bit about the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and the inspiration for its formation and what you do?
So our mission is to eliminate all forms of sexual violence and also to advocate for the rights and needs of victims of sexual assault. We were founded in 1975. That was really because there were several local, mostly volunteer groups of women that were forming around the state to help victims of sexual assault, and they wanted a central place to go to learn from each other, and then also to lobby for funding for victim services, which Pennsylvania actually has a line item that we've had for decades to support this kind of service, and it really is a critical public service that our agencies provide. So that's our brief history, and we work to support a network of 50 rape crisis centers that are serving victims in all 67 counties of the Commonwealth. So our job is to provide training and resources both to employees of the rape crisis centers as well as to other professionals. We want victims to get their needs met no matter which door they're walking through to ask for help. We work on public policies to protect victim rights, hold offenders accountable, and enhance community safety. We work with the media to increase public awareness and make sure that there's accurate information about sexual violence out there. And we also operate the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, which has been around now since 2000. And we provide training and materials nationwide to other state coalitions and also operate the National Sexual Assault Awareness Month campaign.
You're in Washington, D.C. as we speak, working on the lobbying side of it. And you've also been tracking the trial of Bill Cosby this past week. And if you would like to comment on how that trial went and what you think of the outcome.
We attended both trials, mainly to work with the media to make sure that coverage of the content of what was going on in the courtroom was well informed and helping the public recognize much of the same things that the expert witness testifiers provided in each trial, helping people understand that, for instance, delayed reporting of sexual violence is normal and should be expected. That is what we see almost all of the time. Helping people understand that it's very common that, particularly in a non-stranger rape situation, that victims continue to have some form of contact with the person who hurt them, often for weeks or months, trying to sort of figure out how bad it was. It can take people a long time to call it rape or sexual assault. People have a hard time believing that somebody they trusted hurt them that way. So we do that kind of work. And I think in this case in particular, the verdict felt like a victory, but I think even more so now that we're hearing from members of the jury that, quite frankly, they believed Ms. Constand. She seemed credible to them, that Cosby's own words from his deposition in 2005 really incriminated him. And in their eyes, they were able to hear that he had admitted to all elements of the crime. But we have to keep in mind that most criminal trials for sexual assault don't involve testimony from the defendant in which that sort of an admission is included. So it's a little bit of an unusual trial, but definitely one that we hope inspires prosecutors particularly to be willing to take on non-stranger cases where drugs and alcohol are involved, even with a delayed disclosure. It is possible to get a conviction, and it is possible for juries to believe, you know, victims, even if there are inconsistencies or time has passed.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Kristen Hauser, the Chief Public Affairs Officer for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center and the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. Kristen, this kind of thing probably has gone on as far back as there's been history, as far back as there have been men or women. Is that a fair assumption?
It's in the Bible, so I think that's a fair assumption.
Why do you think your organization and others like yours are having so much success now in making people face the consequence of that behavior?
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure if we can measure success right now on consequences, but I do think we have really marked success in recognizing that people care about this issue, and they are recognizing that the shame and stigma that has kept this silent, and when it's silent, it keeps it pervasive, that silence doesn't need to exist anymore. So we're doing a really good job talking about this in real ways, getting support to victims, and when that happens, people often feel like it's safer to come forward and either get help for themselves, confide in friends and family, or even make official reports, which is when accountability comes in. We have seen over the past 20 years or so that the rates of reporting of sexual violence have increased, which is always a good indicator that, because what we know is that victims won't report if they don't trust that they'll be responded to in a way that's helpful. So most people are still not reporting sexual violence, but we have seen an increase.
Kristen, when I shared with some of my inner circles that I was going to do this interview today, they were concerned that there is more frequency of accusations coming to the surface and becoming public, in that there is a concern that there's such quick reaction that there really doesn't seem to be an opportunity for someone who may or may not have been accused. I know that you have some thoughts on that. Share your thinking on what these people need to hear.
There are a couple of things. First of all, we have to keep in mind that false allegations of sexual violence are extremely rare. There are so many barriers and fears that people have about repercussions, retaliation, when we're talking about things in the workplace, and those fears are long-lasting. So there's much higher incentive to say nothing than there is to say something that is untrue. And I think the fact that workplaces are beginning to respond to allegations totally fine and proper. I think as well, people don't recognize that even in the criminal courts, you can convict quite simply only on the testimony of a victim. So you don't need corroborating evidence, even though it's often preferred. But taking somebody's word that something happened is a standard even in the criminal court system.
If people listening to the program would like to find your organization or get more information, how can they do that?
Sure. So we are on the internet, of course, at pcar.org. That's pcar.org. If somebody needs to connect with a rape crisis center in their community to find out about getting services, you can find your local center on the web or by calling 888-772-7227. And then our national center has a different website, which is nsvrc.org. That stands for National Sexual Violence Resource Center. And there you can see all the campaign materials from Sexual Assault Awareness Month and plenty of other things that you can use in your community to raise awareness and support survivors.
This is Joe Geiger on the Lincoln Radio Program. My guest today is Kristen Hauser, the chief public affairs officer for the National Sexual Violence Resource Center and the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape. Kristen, thank you for being a guest on our program.
Thank you, Joe.
U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. is opposing President Trump's nomination of a Pittsburgh attorney to fill an open seat on the 3rd District U.S. Court of Appeals. Beth Ann Mumford of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania provides details on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
A recent poll found that faith in our public institutions is at historic lows. We Pennsylvanians don't need to look far to see why. Consider our own Senator Bob Casey's decision to play party politics with the nomination of Pittsburgh attorney David J. Porter to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Before the date for a confirmation hearing was even announced, Senator Casey expressed his opposition to Mr. Porter's nomination. Senator Casey has a constitutional duty to provide advice and consent on the president's nominees to the federal bench. If Senator Casey chooses to oppose a nominee, that's certainly his prerogative. But that opposition should be grounded in substance, not politics. Senator Casey says Mr. Porter is outside the mainstream, but a careful look at Mr. Porter's record makes clear that charge is unfounded. Mr. Porter is supported by union workers, the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, and the Pittsburgh Firefighters, Local Number 1, just to name a few. Mr. Porter has also been described as someone who is fair and qualified and has respect from colleagues inside and outside his firm. Until recently, Senator Casey could have blocked Mr. Porter's nomination simply by using what is known as the blue slip process. The blue slip was meant to encourage consultation between the executive branch and the Senate. But in recent years, it's been abused by both parties for partisan advantage and has contributed to gridlock in the confirmation process. We have more than 150 vacant federal judgeships today. This obstruction has real-world impacts. It leads to case backlogs and overworked judges and delays our citizens getting their day in court. And as we all know, justice delayed is justice denied. Recent reforms have ended some such abuses, and the Senate is confirming highly qualified nominees like Mr. Porter. But the process is still too slow and too steeped in politics. Our elected officials should stop playing politics with these judicial vacancies and do the right thing by putting the people of Pennsylvania before party politics. I'm Beth Ann Mumford, State Director of Americans for Prosperity. Find us on the web at www.afppennsylvania.org.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 23 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WQXA-FM in York, WLSW-FM, and WQTA-AM in Connellsville, along with WPGM-FM in Danville, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. All of them have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.